Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicholas Davis, a research scientist at the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M University and a lecturer at the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He is currently at work on a book about the popular meaning of democracy, and he is the co-author of a recent study, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Davis.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And Nicholas, your study finds that there's a correlation between the increasing intolerance of white Americans and the support for authoritarian rule. In other words, when intolerant white people are afraid of that a democracy will benefit minorities in particular, they abandon their commitments to democracy. So in other words, is the Republican Party moving away from family values to white nationalism?
So we can trace this back in the survey data to the mid-90s. And what we found, pretty early on when we had the available survey data was that the percentage of people espousing out-group intolerance was relatively modest. It was really around 10 to 12%. And the most recent survey we've got from 2011 suggested it's increased about a quarter. And so we don't have the most recent wave of the World Value Surveys to see whether or not this has increased even further. But if that trend extrapolated out to 2017, then we would expect to see something like one in three people. And so that's actually pretty worrisome. And so whether or not that characterizes mainstream Republicans, I'm not sure. Certainly when we talk about the correlation between conservatism and social intolerance, that is relatively high. But whether or not we're talking about Republicans as mainstream, it's not abundantly clear, but that distinction may be less interesting insofar as it does seem like a certain subsect of Republicans have sort of co-opted the party from its kind of traditional mainstream family values and really pushed it right on matters of race generally and more recently immigration specifically.
Well, there's nothing more stark in terms of family values and upholding them than having children ripped from their parents at the southern border. And while it obviously has maintained enormous support for Donald Trump, and he believes, I think the reason he's making an issue out of the border is that he's doing well by it with his base and riling them up. But in the case of the children being ripped from their parents, at least some of the religious right leaders who've unswervingly supported him, like Franklin Graham, did at least utter some criticism, did they not?
That's right, they did. And so I think you see something of a break in at least very recently with evangelicals stepping in and saying, maybe this isn't okay. Maybe we should seek to keep children with their mothers. But what's curious is you don't necessarily see them making the distinction regarding how these people are treated as it's related to being rounded up through ports of entry, right? And so it seems like out of one side of the mouth you get we should keep families together as they're processed through the legal channels. But there, it does seem like at least the underlying kind of identity-driven appeals that Trump is making regarding non-white individuals, right? So immigrants, it does seem to play well with this group of people. So it really is a delicate dance, I think, that there's a very fine line that these religious leaders are walking, because I do think they sense that this is not okay, and I do think they are getting pushback from their congregations. But that kind of runs headlong into the idea that what it means to be an American is to keep others who are not Americans out if they're willing to come via channels that they consider are inappropriate or not legal.
Well, in that regard, the president was just handed a gift from the Supreme Court, and he's extremely pleased with the ruling upholding his Muslim travel ban. Mm-hmm. And it now means that people from Muslim-majority countries like Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen can't come in, of course, as well as North Korean and Venezuelan. But there again, it would seem that the court is strengthening Trump's hand. And since apparently the law, United States Code, USC 1182F, apparently is bolstered by this ruling, and it essentially gives President Trump not just latitude in banning Muslims, but also cracking down further on the border, which I think we can expect. So it seems like the five conservative justices on the Supreme Court, would you categorize them as drifting away from family values towards white identity politics?
Well, so I'm not a judicial scholar, but I do think that it does kind of play into the burbling narrative that the United States needs to be very careful about outsiders, right? And so that ruling does sort of strengthen Donald Trump's hand to say, the idea that America first is what we should be pursuing is not only supported by my supporters, right, but look at these justices have handed down a ruling that really does support what I'm trying to do. And what he's going to end up doing is conflating. So the justices are going to argue that what they're doing is just interpreting the law. Donald Trump will interpret that as, well, they're actually tacitly supporting my policy initiatives, right? And so there is some, those two things are subtly different. But I think you're right that this does sort of play into Donald Trump's general rhetoric that we should be excluding these types of individuals from the United States simply by virtue of their country of origin.
Yes, so Chief Justice Roberts, in handing down the opinion, said the travel ban was squarely within the scope of presidential authority. Mm-hmm. But clearly, and while it's probably right for them to reject the idea that what he said on the stump isn't necessarily relevant to what he's done as mm-hmm. president, on the other hand, there's no consistency in this Muslim travel ban. Saudi Arabia, which is responsible for, 15 of the 19 hijackers in 9/11, mm-hmm. they get a free pass. You know,
right.
So what's going on there? And they're the ones that have been spreading a very hot anti-Western version of Islam for decades now.
Yeah, well, so I think part of what's going on is that there's some indiscriminacy regarding who this applies to. And Trump is not necessarily one who thinks with a clear logic, I think, regarding connecting the dots on this sort of stuff. And so I frankly, as an American, my purview is mostly American democracy. So I'm not sure the justification for why some countries and not others. But I do think it sort of points back to a curious inconsistency that the administration is sort of willing to willy-nilly apply these sorts of rules to countries that they just perceive to either be amenable to U.S. interests or to be hostile based on, you know, things that are totally out of the control of folks from those countries.
So let's focus in on how the Republican Party has become the Trump Party. That's what John Boehner recently said, and I think it's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. And that essentially the choice between bigotry and democracy is at stake here, and it seems to be that Donald Trump is enabling the first while abandoning the second. Our previous guest, Jennifer Machia, who is at Texas A&M University, she's an historian mm-hmm. of presidential mm-hmm. rhetoric. I asked her about whether or not it's a deliberate tactic on Donald Trump's part to further polarize an already polarized and tribal country, which is what he appears to do, and the extent to which he's also setting a trap for Democrats to reciprocate and abandon mm-hmm. the advice given by former First Lady Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. Do you think that's at play here?
Yeah, I think he wants to set up as many tricky traps as he can to get involved in spats that have little to do with the popular issues of the day, right? So he's going to pounce on, you know, Maxine Waters, he's going to pounce on her rhetoric. He's going to ignore the substance of what she's saying and try to portray this as see what the Democrats are doing. And I think he's looking for any chance he can get to make this about kind of cheap points to take people away from the real difficult subject matter of children being separated from parents at the border, right? And so the more he can do the fact of the matter is the United States is a country that has laws, right? And so anything that he can do to try to push Democrats into a corner, he wants to make this a very easy decision for people who are amenable to his vision of America. He wants to make Democrats seem lawless. He wants to make them seem like they don't have the interests of the country at heart. And so anything he can do to simplify and really distill politics down to sort of a guttural racial identity, right, a national identity, anything he can do to distill political debate down to those terms is just going to trigger and play right into his hand. And his supporters, they seem to really feed off that. And so I think the Democrats are going to have a hard time combating that on those terms, because there just doesn't seem to be a shared consensus about, in some sense, American values, right? Because the idea of tolerance is really baked into the idea of democracy. And so given that there seems to be no real agreement on what constitutes appropriate levels of tolerance towards others, I think that he's playing the right hand as it relates to his end game.
Well, but he's also, is he not, signaling that he's actually said this many times, effectively, that the Democrats don't care about white Americans, they only care about minorities. And that's the cleavage that he's exploiting, is he not?
Sticking his thumb right in it.
Right, that somebody said that demographics are destiny. But both Trump and his supporters are kind of like King Canute, trying to stop the tide, the demographic inevitability that whites will become a minority in this country. What I find extraordinary is that in the face of the relentless insults against Mexicans and the treatment currently going on the border, which is absolutely inhumane and immoral, there's no evidence that there's a huge uptick in Latino voting. So Trump may win in 2018 and 2020. His people are fired up and ready to vote, but it doesn't appear that the people he's insulting are necessarily going to step up and fight back.
That's right. I mean, when you look at the correlates of vote intention and then voter turnout, white people turn out at much higher rates oftentimes than in people of color. And so whether he triggers a backlash, it doesn't necessarily seem that for all of his rhetoric that he's going to pay an electoral price as it relates to compelling different blocks of people from turning out to vote. The parties have had an awkward relationship with Latino voters for the last eight to 12 years. And so neither party seems to make inroads like the Democratic Party has with African Americans, right? And so if Trump can manage to thread this needle and use this vernacular of exclusion and encourage his white supporters to come out and vote without triggering a compensatory wave of individuals who are of Latino background to come out and vote for Democrats, then I think it's highly likely that he walks away without a huge electoral penalty.
And since you and your co-author, Stephen Miller, Nicholas Davis, the information you used for your new report, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy, comes from the World Values Survey, can we try and figure out to my mind, the progenitor of much of this is Vladimir Putin in Russia. And people like Stephen Bannon admire, and I think Trump does too, certainly admires Putin, we're not sure why. In Bannon's case, he made it clear that Putin is a champion of Christian values and white nationalism, and he's standing up against the tide, he's against homosexuals, he's against European liberalism, and he's managed to project those values, if that's the right way to put it, into Hungary and Poland and now Austria and a number of Western Europeans with countries like Germany with the AfD are heading in this path. What is that peculiar political correlation between white nationalism, anti-immigrant feelings, and creeping fascism?
Well, I think at its core, it's a desire for homogenization. I think we see these trends. You're right. We see these trends across Europe. We see them in Russia, and they do seem to be spreading. We see to some extent the National Front, right, in France, made the presidential runoff. UKIP was largely fueled by some of the same anti-immigrant sentiments that we see popping up in the United States. And so
They succeeded with Brexit, right? I mean,
that's right.
Brexit
that's right.
was all about white nationalism and the exclusion of the other.
That's right. And so, you know, we do see these movements popping up. And I think that's why, you know, books like How Democracies Die are vital in the moment, because they are giving some kind of cross-national context to what to expect when these things happen. You know, in some of these countries, the underlying institutional structure makes it a little bit easier for, you know, far-right populist parties to gain traction. You know, in the United States, it does seem like a segment of Republicans have sort of captured and co-opted the party. I do think that there is enough soft pushback from Republicans that this probably, yeah, I have to hedge, it probably won't go quite as far as it has in other countries. But I think that's certainly the real danger. I think you've definitely tapped into something that certainly political scientists are still trying to understand.
And I forget to mention in that list of Eastern European and Western European countries that Italy has now just turned to the far right, and the new interior ministry, who's apparently the power behind the throne, Salvini, his mentor is Stephen Bannon, and he's totally in that category. So it is quite evident what's happening. But when you talk about moderate Republicans pushing back, the only ones that are standing up to Trump are all resigning.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
Right.
So the counter argument to my statement that you think moderate Republicans will do something is that you're right. It does seem like many of these individuals who have provided some amount of friction to Trump are all disinclined to continue participating in politics, and so it has opened up, I think, the opportunity for Democrats to be perhaps a little more electorally successful in the fall. It certainly has increased their chances to take back some seats. But as far as intra-party, within the party moderation, you just don't see it yet. And whether or not we see it, I'm sure is something of an open question. I think that's right.
So is it all sort of, does it all go back to the idea that the Democrats had the Dixiecrats, and the minute the civil rights happened in this country with the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court just yesterday eviscerated?
That's right.
And I think in many ways, I think that's the key, at least to what we were talking about, what Jennifer Machio about, was when Mitch McConnell refused to allow even a hearing for Merrick Garland. And for reasons I don't understand, Obama basically was defeated. I don't know why he couldn't have fought back more, but that was a key moment, and it's all been downhill since then. And now you can see that having Neil Gorsuch on the court has made all the difference. The rulings that we talked about today and we talked about yesterday with today's upholding of the Muslim ban, they wouldn't have happened without Gorsuch. So that seems to be the sort of lesson here. And doesn't that play into that old adage, nice guys finish last?
I think so. You know, and I think looking back, Democrats will think that it was a calculated mistake not to harp on the presidential election in 2016 as a referendum on the Supreme Court. I mean, certainly conservatives were willing to make that case, and they made it openly. I think Democrats were sensitive of it, but I don't know that they necessarily ran on that as a pillar of their platform. You know, you said something interesting about Dixiecrats and how, you know, we see the sorting out of conservatives to the Republican Party and liberals to the Democratic Party really happen in earnest after the Civil Rights Act. And one of the things that never went away, while it might have remained a bit more latent under the surface, was racial animosity. The history of the United States is one in which race has been the defining cleavage of both partisan politics, but also economics and across a variety of domains. And even though the Civil Rights Act passes, these things don't just go away. They're institutionalized. And so I think what you're seeing now is sort of the final manifestation, but the eventual manifestation of a lot of burbling tensions that have just been sitting latent since this sorting out of conservatives to the Republican Party and liberals to the Democratic Party. And in some sense, This sorting out has got us to where we are today, in that we see that there's not only kind of an ideological sorting, but it's almost something of a racial sorting as well. And so this was almost always going to have happened, right? Like, hindsight's 20/20. But certainly the tensions that give us this sort of nativist, racially resentful party, these things have certainly existed in the rhetoric of politicians all across the South for the last 50 years.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicholas Davis.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Davis, who's a research scientist at the Public Policy Research Institute at Texas A&M University and a lecturer in the School of Government and Public Policy at the University of Arizona. He is currently at work on a book about the popular meaning of democracy, and he is the co-author of a recent study, White Outgroup Intolerance and Declining Support for American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and back and look into the root causes of why migrants are fleeing Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and El Salvador.